Welcome to the River Talk Podcast. This is a podcast about rafting, kayaking, whitewater stuff, hosted by my friends Eric Weiseth and Priscilla Macy, who are both gone today. So we're here with my friend Dougie Fresh. Welcome, Dougie.
Thanks.
And Chris Baer is here to talk about his recent trip to China and this river guide quiz that I put up on the internet. And so welcome to the show, Chris.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Chris, I know a little bit about you. I'm going to try to phrase what I know. And you're a longtime river guide. You guide a lot in Colorado and also like a prolific kayaker who every winter you seem to go off on some crazy adventure in some new place. Does that kind of sum it up?
Yeah, that seems pretty reasonable. Yeah, I try to get out of the country for at least a few months almost every winter. Try to go someplace a little off the beaten track on a regular basis.
And it always seems like it's like somewhere new too. Like you never don't seem to repeat. You just like always choose some new place.
I've repeated a couple things. Like I've been down to Chile a couple times. That place is pretty top tier. It's hard not to go back there. But yeah, consistently going to different places, trying to check out something new, trying to figure out something different. I don't know. I've got that itch to kind of go around the corner all the time.
Yeah, I think Dougie and I do too. We love traveling as well. And the most recent place you went is China. And I was following you a little bit on Facebook about your trip there and saw some photos. But of course, the coronavirus came up. Do you want to talk about your trip and then your escape?
Sure. Yeah, the trip was cool. It's talk about a place that has been very underutilized for whitewater. Like you got the biggest mountains in the world coming out of there, and go figure there's some pretty massive rivers coming out of there as well. And so headed on over to the western portion of it, kind of the edge of Tibet, piling a bunch of the three river drainages stuff in there. And it's huge. It's like all three of the major rivers coming out of there are Grand Canyon size or bigger. Huge rapids in there, like super tame stuff and some like gigantic stuff. But did some kayaking for me, helped out a couple commercial businesses over there. They're trying to do some kayaking or some rafting over there, some commercial rafting, help guide some stuff, help do some safety kayak stuff over there. And then this whole corona thing broke out, and I think the entire globe thought it was kind of a joke at first and somebody was just hung over. But turns out it was kind of getting wild. And so, yeah, I kept on checking the posts and seeing what was going on and checking the death toll, and it kept on doubling and doubling, and it kept on bouncing against like how many people in the United States die from the flu every year, which is like 6,000, which is a crazy number. Like that's blows me away. And coronavirus isn't even close to that yet, but it's infected a lot of people, and it's causing a lot of stuff, and China basically shut down. We were hanging out New Year's Eve with some of the boys, drinking beers, and my Chinese is pretty much non-existent. So I was using a translation app on the phone. And so we're all like joking and picking on each other and drinking beers New Year's Eve. And then I wake up the next morning and everybody's got a mask on. The word kind of went out in China, and basically China shut down overnight. All the buses weren't going, taxis weren't going. All the hotels were told to close their doors. It basically just closed overright. So the next day...
Closed. Do you have places to stay?
There was like no consideration about foreigners being over there or anything else. It was like people that were at a place could kind of stay. And I had kind of a connection into this hotel that I was helping to do some business for. And so I had a place to stay, but it was all closing down around us. It was kind of wild. It was like get out now kind of thing. And caught a car ride for a couple hours, showed up to an airport that was had a sign on it that was basically like we're closed due to the coronavirus and we're running these like crazy limited hours, and hung around in the snow at 10,000 feet in Shangri-La, which doesn't have dragons, and that sucks.
But there's actually a town called Shangri-La in China.
Yeah. But it's like it's kind of a farce. Like it's got a different name, and that like it's got an original name. But the Shangri-La like story tale thing, the Chinese government decided that there was enough interest in that they were going to rename a town.
Okay, so it's not they need it based on the fairy tale idea.
Yeah.
Okay.
But there's no dragons. That's that just sucks.
I mean, dragons aren't real, so that makes sense.
Chris, when did you finally fly out?
That was like 4 days ago or 5 days ago. And then it was like a 3-day process to get out. End up staying, like sleeping in the in the airport one night, waiting for the next flight to get out. So flew from Shangri-La into Kunming, which is like a little puddle jumper flight, but a couple hundred miles, and then crashed the night in the Kunming airport, and then flew into Hong Kong the next day, and got a quick flight out of there back to LA, and then the LA flight back to Atlanta, where I flew out from originally, was canceled or like all mucked up. So cruised up to Chicago and then back down to Atlanta. So I've infected the entire country.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, did you see anybody that had it when you were over there?
No, and that's the crazy thing is, like, you can't tell. From what I understand, it's a flu, right? So, like, if somebody has it or doesn't have it, it just looks like somebody has the flu. And, like, you can't – how do you tell if somebody's got the flu? Like, coughing? Or did they just swallow a peanut or, you know, like
– Wow, well, pretty crazy. Well, welcome back to the U.S. We're glad you made it back safely.
Yeah, been trying to do some Corona since I got back.
Yeah. So what we want to do, you know, I put up a river guide quiz a few weeks ago, and my intention with the quiz was, you know, we teach a lot of education here with my company, and we do like professional guide education and private boaters. And I took an International Rafting Federation class last year, and they created a quiz. I took a quiz that they had, and I just didn't think it was very good. And I'm like, I can do better than that quiz. So I tried. I'm like, I'm going to try to make a quiz, which is hard. And I put it online for people to just try out and give me feedback. And Chris, you're one of the first people that gave me feedback. And you just said, hey, reach out. Let's talk. And I feel like you had a lot of thoughts about it. And I think this quiz for me is like a first draft. You know, I'm getting feedback. And you're a super experienced guide. So I'm hoping to get some feedback from you on how to make the quiz better. And and I think the key to the quiz, there's with voting, I think a lot of us agree there's not always a right or wrong answer always, but there's one that's like pretty sure it's right.
It's and, like the medical test where they're like, pick the best answer.
Yeah, there's like, and I the more I think about standards, I sort of think we need standards in the industry. I meet a lot of guides who learn something somewhere else that's like pretty wrong. And I understand that like the thing they learned at the place they learned it made sense, but only makes sense in that operation. And I feel like we sort of need a baseline that people generally agree on that are like principles to use. And if you go work somewhere else, that company might say, oh yeah, like that, we get that's the standard. We do it differently here because of this thing. But so I think it's okay to differ from these standards, but I think there's a base set of education that people should have. And so this is an attempt to test that base set of education. And, you know, I have a friend who has a guide quiz, and it's fill in the blank, or it's like write a paragraph about it or draw diagrams. And that's a good idea. It's just incredibly hard to grade. Where multiple choice, you know, this isn't hard to grade. You can give this to a guide and you can get an answer.
And I think that for a base level understanding, for like trying to like edit out kind of where folks are, I think that makes a ton of sense. From, and like I just saw it and I was thinking about us training guides at the rafting shop, and I don't really, we do like a multiple guest thing with them, but I really could care less. Like, I almost want them to write in an answer. I want them to like think outside the box. I want them to understand the variables that are out there and like could be bigger than the answers. Like from somebody that I'm going to work with, like, man, I love seeing that. And I'm willing to take all the time in the world to grade my prospective coworker versus just trying to rattle it off.
I mean, you're okay if you're working Gore Canyon with five guides, but if you're working on the Arkansas and you have to train 40 guides, that's a little harder.
Yeah, and we're training like good 20 of them a year kind of thing. And it's still such a small class. And like at that point, by the time you get done with 2, 3, 4 weeks of training with those folks, you kind of understand where their level is.
Yeah,
but I think using it as that, like you were saying, like using it to understand where people are coming in from, I think it could be useful for sure.
And it's also a conversation starter. So let's say you take the quiz. Like when I took the IRF course quiz, there were some questions I was like, this is way too vague. I can see three different answers. But the conversations that we had afterwards, after we graded, like I wasn't failed because I missed some questions. It wasn't like you got two questions wrong, you're not a good guide. I would then went to the instructor and was like, let's talk about these. And he's like, yeah, no, I see those gray areas. So, you know, you take the quiz, using the quiz as a teaching tool, you take it, and then the discussions that follow, I think, are really powerful. And that's the discussions I want to have with you now. Like, let's have those discussions.
I mean, like, I think I got 20% on your test. You know, like, I failed out of it.
I think you wrote in your own answers a lot, and so other buttons didn't count either. So I'm going to go through some of the questions, and I think just having discussion and getting your thoughts and Dougie chiming in. And so the first question is, when is a good time to deploy a throwback from a raft? And the answers are anytime you have a swimmer, anytime you have a swimmer you can't reach with a paddle, never, or never unless there's a high probability of be saving them from severe injury or death. And I think some people didn't read the question. This question is, when do you deploy it from a raft, not from shore? Chris, what do you think about throwing throwbacks from a raft?
I don't do it very often. I do it very, very infrequently.
Yeah, like almost never.
Yeah, basically, I mean, unless they are, you know, like, I kind of would go with that C answer on there, like, that, like, unless there's an imminent risk.
Yep.
Or if we're just in some place that's super benign, like, there's so many of those giant rivers that it's, like, wide open, it's super benign, and mom's over there, and she's kind of freaking out, and I just want to close this down right now because somebody else is crying in the boat and the little kid's doing this, and I just want to, like, I want to close the situation up as fast as possible, and I don't think that the rope is going to create more hazard at that point.
And the reason this question is important to me, because there have been fatalities from river guides throwing people throwbacks from a raft
for sure.
So it's definitely, I think, commonly seen as a hazard. But I was talking to somebody who taught rafting the other day, and he thought it was okay to throw, but he was teaching people to throw throwbacks from a raft. And so that's what I want to avoid. It's like it's not a preferred method. It's like a last case scenario type thing.
Yeah. But like, if you go up to the Ottawa and you're on, you know, 30,000 CFS and you get done with the rapid and now you're in a lake, like the risk of throwing that bag out there is pretty darn low. Mm-hmm. And we've had 12 people in your boat, and now you're collecting all 12 of them to, like, throw a bag out here and, like, grab some people. Like, it's just so dependent on the location.
Yeah.
And I agree, like, what you guys are on up there in the Pacific Northwest, like, no way, man. Like, I'm not throwing ropes up there. Like, I'm going to go steer my boat over there and toss them in the boat. And I kind of do the same thing on Gali and Ark and, like, tons of other places.
So, but the idea here is, in general, we should feel like you don't throw a boat for you. That should be a general among guides. You don't throw throwbacks from rafts.
Yeah, it's a low thing. Like, I want to go through all the rest of my options, or like, have deemed this situation so benign that I'm not worried about it.
Yeah. So the answer to that question was never unless my answer to it was never unless there's a higher probability you'll be saving someone from severe injury or death.
I got that one right.
Dougie, good job.
I would say never, except for some circumstances. Maybe not quite as extreme as you put in there, but like Chris was saying, unless there's some special circumstances, like you're on a big, like, you don't have to explain all the ones, but basically a little step back from your severity.
Oh, so like never unless there's a high probability you'll be saving them from severity. No. Severe injury or death, or like if it makes sense on the Ottawa high water.
Never unless there is.
If you exhausted the rest of your options, or like it's deemed to make itself, but you know, like, it's so gray. I think that's where I came down with like so many of these questions was like, I'm just like grayed them all out.
Yeah.
No, they're almost all gonna be gray, and that's the real world. again, we're looking for just a base standard that people kind of agree to, like in guiding. And then, but there are examples of, you know, like maybe in the Grand Canyon, there's a reason to do something. But like, I want guides coming to me knowing that you don't throw throwbacks from a raft unless there's extreme circumstances. I don't want them to think like, oh yeah, it's normal standard procedure.
And yeah, which is crazy because like Golly back in the day, that was like standard. It was like, I remember one of the guides like yelling at all the quote unquote Kool-Aids one year. Like, if people are out of the boat, I want to see, you know, like I want to hear whistles blasting and throw bags flying. Like they're adamant about just throwing bags and blowing whistles versus like, hey man, let's go forward a couple strokes and go get that person out of the water.
Yeah. But I think the general standard among boaters is you don't throw a throwback from a raft. And I think the best way to get that across to people is a quiz like this.
Sure.
Versus me just walking around.
Get them to think about it.
Yeah, at least thinking about it.
And like, if we are going to go with the, is it the best answer? Yeah, that's the best answer that's on there.
Yeah. 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 So let's move on to the next one. This one's pretty straightforward. A 2-to-1 mechanical advantage system requires how many pulleys to minimize friction?
One.
Yeah, this is a no-brainer, right? One. Yeah, a few people.
I saw a couple of the answers where people were saying other things and like, well, you're not actually creating a 2-to-1. You're creating something else.
Yeah. Yeah. And a few people give me a hard time that I should talk about 3-to-1s because that's what people more commonly use.
Why?
I think this was just a hard question. Like, this is like semi-advanced. You have to know more than just like the stuff you learn in 3-to-1s. So yeah, the answer is one. And basically it's just one moving pulley creates 2-to-1. Next one's, after you flip, you should immediately A, count your passengers, B, get on the upside down raft and count your passengers, C, get on the upside down raft and start pulling passengers in your boat, or D, take a deep breath and relax. This one I purposely made tough. Like, they're all things you should do.
Right.
But what are your priorities?
I started with number one, count your passengers. I could have seen other options, though.
In my mind, it's hard to count your passengers when you're floating in the river next to a boat. Like, you can't literally count everybody until you're on the boat. Like, that's a practical thing.
I can see that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm thinking about, like, worst-case scenarios. Like, we're up on Gore, and, like, there's the Civ over there. Like, my first priority might be swim right really, really hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like, self-preservation always is first.
Right. That's a good point.
So I rewrote this. So I've rewritten the quiz, Chris, just so you know. And in my new, based on feedback, my new quiz starts after you flip and you look out for yourself, then what do you do? So like, you're right. Self-preservation is priority. But my thinking is step one is to get on the raft. Like, you can't do anything if you're not on your raft. That's what like we're taught to do right away is like you flip, get on your boat. Mm-hmm. And then do a head
curse underneath your breath twice and then get on top of the boat and start figuring out where everybody is.
Yep. So my answer for this was B, get on the upside down raft and catch your passengers. And I understand different situations. Like, there might be this one time you flipped and there's other examples outside of it. But generally, we all agree that like you want to get on that boat as fast as you can and count people.
Yeah. You got to figure out where they are and you got to see what's coming up. Like, there's so many options where.
Yep.
Oh, like maybe flipped off of the new strainer that's there, you know, like what else has been new that you didn't know about? What, you know, like there's so many options there. But yeah, get up, get so you can see, figure out where all the folks are, start cleaning up your mess.
Yep. And I the C answer, pulling your passengers in the boat, I don't like that because sometimes you might just do a quick reflip depending on the situation. Like, you don't always flip on the boat. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. But you definitely need to count everybody.
Man, I like Golly, especially like back in the day when we were flipping a lot out there. A lot. I never pulled anybody on top of upside down boat. It was pop up, get on that boat, do a quick scan, make sure like I can see all my clients. They're all like cursing or at least breathing or laughing or whatever they're doing. Roll that thing right side up and then start yarding them back in.
Yep. And the IRF class, if I remember, the standard was pull the people on your boat. I found in reality, if you pull them on the boat and then flip it, you basically have to pull them back in again.
Yeah, you're going to exhaust yourself and them.
Yeah, if you can do a reflip on your own before pulling them in, it just saves you from having them swimming twice. Yeah,
twice the work.
Yep. So next one is safety talks should take A, about 10 minutes, B, 11 minutes, 43 seconds, C, about 20 minutes, D, as long as it takes to cover everything, and then the E, it really doesn't matter as long as the passengers are entertained.
You got to drop those funny jokes.
Yeah, it helps. I have some pretty, like, I have my jokes. You probably, we all have our jokes. Yeah. And in thinking about it and talking to Mark, who's with the IRF, there's definitely a balance with jokes. Like, if you do too many jokes, people stop taking you seriously. So there's like a tone thing that I'm starting to pay attention to more with my safety talks. And some of the jokes make it take a lot longer and you can lose people's interest. So, like, I think the jokes are important for, like, keeping people engaged. But if you do too many of them and you come off, like, as a jokester,
it doesn't work. They're not paying attention.
Yeah. And so,
especially around tipping, there's that joke that people always say.
Which one?
I give people
any of them.
Shaft of the paddle, the tip of the paddle, not the shaft. There's that joke about how to reach to somebody. I can't remember the joke, but
you're telling it well.
Yeah.
I mean, I have now is an Avengers themed safety talk. It started off as an Iron Man safety talk and it moved on to Avengers. And so I now have Avengers references through my safety talk it's only funny because I'm making fun of how nerdy I am. And I feel like it gets people's attention back a little bit when I'm going through these kind of tedious things, I'll make a reference to get them to kind of laugh or be at ease a little bit. That's just a tool.
I have a tendency to use like a little bit of humor in there just to see who's paying attention.
Yeah.
Like you can literally like look through the crowd and see if they smirk or see if they're just staring at the stars. Like you can kind of see who's paying attention, and you can kind of like, if you need to, you can make sure that they get a little bit more information or whatever, especially on some of those harder sections.
Yeah. And it makes you more likable. If you're funny, you're likable, and then people want to listen to you. So this was the most controversial question in terms of people leaving comments about the test. And do you guys have thoughts about what the answer would be here?
Go ahead, please.
I would say D.
As long as it takes to cover everything? Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's the answer, but we have to be concerned about their willingness to continue to be there. Like they're just, you're going to burn them out. And heck, even the 10 minute one is perceivably long for trying to keep people's attention that are supposed to be on vacation. It's gotta be concise.
Yep. So I meant the answer to be a 10 minutes, but you have to cover everything.
Yeah.
So most people answered as long as it takes to cover everything. And I believe that.
Yeah,
for sure. A teacher wrote me a note after this about this. He said in teaching, if people want to know the information, you have 20 minutes of interest. If they don't want to know the information, you have 5. Safety talks aren't things that people necessarily want to know. So I think you have 10 minutes of time.
Yeah.
But you have to cover everything too.
Yeah.
So I rewrote this question in the new one that says safety talks should cover everything and take about how long?
Yeah.
So in this one, the answer is probably as long as it takes to cover everything.
Yeah.
Or 10 minutes, but the new one, the answer will be 10 minutes.
And a multi-day might be different from a one day.
It could be. Like, that's the thing, is like the Grand Canyon, right? Like people say, well, on the Grand Canyon, my talk takes this long. I think, though, the
safety talk. Grand Canyon talk shouldn't take any longer for safety. Like you might have other information about like how to use the groover and like what the kitchen setup is and like everything else. But like the actual safety talk, it has to be concise.
So my multi-day talks, like I won't talk about how to use the groover or how to eat or how to like watch out for rattlesnakes. I don't talk about that in the safety talk. Mm-hmm. I talk about it at lunch and at camp. I give it in small pieces instead of like this 45-minute talk about how to like pick up micro trash and, you know, watch out for this. I'm like, here's boating safety. Let's go boating. And then at lunch, I'll talk about sanitation. I'll talk about rattlesnakes. And at camp, I'll talk about the groover and that stuff. So I feel like, you know, or like the other example people gave me other than the Grand Canyon is Cherry Creek. You know, that talk takes, there's more stuff to cover. but it's also more, you're more engaged. Like you're, they're putting you in the boat. They're making you do some tests. So I can see how Cherry Creek talk could take longer, but if you're a passenger in Cherry Creek, you're intently listening to everything people are saying probably, cause you're probably scared that day versus
or you're just so bravado. You don't pay any attention.
Yeah, no, that's true. That's
and
true.
You've probably heard this safety talk before too.
Yeah. It's not your first time boating. Yeah. So I get that he has a harder safety talk. I'm sure that Gore Canyon probably has a harder safety talk, but like the normal, like class three talk where there's 30 people listening to one person, that thing needs to be 10 minutes. Yeah. And a lot of people tell me that it can't be 10 minutes. If you practice it, it can be. Like if you
dude, on your I can own, give you a good one in like 6 minutes. Yep. It's fast. I'm cutting out a lot of the BS, but I can make it happen in 6 minutes.
Yep. Yeah. But I think a good guide has the 6 minute one and the 20 minute one. Cause sometimes the crew is like, hey, we got to go. Like something's happening with the water
right.
or yeah. there's a trip about to launch. We got to get ahead of this one trip. Give it, go through the bases, get it done in 6 minutes. Sometimes like the gear is on. Sometimes it's like, hey, we got to still get the boats in the water. Can you give your 25 minute talk that keeps people entertained? You know? So like a good guide can pull off either based on the circumstance as well. But I think the 10 minute standard is, I think, and that's the IRF standard. So I'm into it. So it sounds like we're in agreement so far. No, I was hoping for more controversy. Maybe we'll get some. The most important part of a city talk is A, it's all equally important. B, wearing PPE. PPE is personal protective equipment. That's life jacket, that kind of stuff. So wearing PPE and avoiding foot entrapments. C, how to paddle as a team. D, what to do when you swim. E, no drugs or alcohol. What do you guys think?
I liked number B, wearing all the gear and foot entrapments, but I went with A. It's all equally important.
So this is kind of, I made this purposely a trick question.
Okay.
There is no way that how to paddle as a team is as equally important as wearing your life jacket.
Sure it is. They're not in the water equally. In the first place.
Yeah, it'll avoid people swimming.
Yeah.
Yeah, but equally, like, I would much rather have a boat full of guests wearing life jackets than a boat full of guests that can paddle. The life jacket, you literally, if you fall out in an army life jacket,
but you're not there's a good chance you'll die. Equal.
I'm saying wearing entrapments is the most important part.
I mean, I almost went with that.
Chris, do you disagree? I want this agreement.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, honestly, I would take the group that could paddle because then they're just going to stay in the boat and we won't need the life jacket at all.
That's, I don't know.
I mean, you do.
I mean, that's crazy, but I'll take it.
Like, as far as if there's a swimmer, being able to get them, getting through rapids, like, it's just, it's important. And then what to do if you swim is important. It's all pretty important.
No, are they equally important? Is no drugs or alcohol as important as paddling as a team?
No, I've taken plenty of wasted people rafting.
Okay, but maybe one of them is lower priority, but the other four, I don't know.
So it's not all equally important then? Like, it's saying that all four of these are equally important. This is almost a trick question. It's making you pick. So I have this opinion about this that I'm probably forcing on the quiz, where I feel like if you look at how people die boating, like deaths, it's either not wearing a life jacket, alcohol related, cold water immersion, or foot entrapments. That's like most of it. So if you're wearing your PFD and you're wearing proper clothes, which is like wetsuit if it's cold, that takes out cold water immersion typically. And then foot entrapments are the other one. And you can't control foot entrapments. So if I have guests that are wearing, if they're wearing their equipment and they know to avoid foot entrapments,
it's very important.
I'm okay if they swim a class five. Like, I don't want them to swim a class five, but I've seen a lot of people swim class five rapids and come out perfectly fine.
Yeah.
So like that to me is just so critical that they wear that stuff. I don't want people loosening their life jackets. I want them to wear their shoes if they fall out, and I want them wearing their shoes. Yeah.
No, it's important. It's definitely important. Is it
the most important part?
Probably it's the most important.
That's what the question is.
But they're all the other ones are pretty close. So by saying that they're not all equal important, I feel like you're saying that paddling as a team is not important. But
it's important. It's just not as important.
Okay.
It's kind of a trick question.
Yeah. I get where you're going with it. Man, I just always laughed at, like, the, well, what's the phrasing? Just, like, the avoidance is, like, the biggest thing, right? So if they just stay in the boat, none of the rest of that stuff even comes into play.
Yeah, prevention.
But just because they can paddle as a team doesn't mean they're going to avoid. I mean, you could be a crappy guide.
Yeah, I mean, they still end up in the first year guide's boat and they crash and blow up, or
yeah, they can
end
be up in the 30th
year guide and blow up. Yeah,
the best paddling team ever. If they're wearing life jackets, they can swim the whole South Fork of the American with a life jacket on, right? But you know, if they don't have the life jacket on, they're gonna you swim once. There's a good chance you're gonna die in a rapid. Like, that's how important life jackets are. And cold water immersion is, I think, one of the biggest causes of fatalities for commercial rafting. So wearing that wetsuit and paddle jacket when it's required, I think, is huge.
Yeah, the cold water things, it's amazing how that just saps energy, turns people off.
It turns people off, but also there's the, and this is big in Colorado, you know, there's people that fall out and that cold water puts them into a cold water shock. And so there's several ways people die from the immediate cold water shock. And it's happened in Colorado, it's a big deal. And I think you look at a lot of fatalities in the commercial boating industry, they come from somebody falling out, and it's that immediate cold. It's not hypothermia, it's the immediate cold water shock to your body that's actually deadly.
So your goal in this question is getting guys to think, to prioritize.
To emphasize that. That's really important.
That's your goal of this question is like.
When you give a safety talk, that's critical. You talk about wearing your stuff and how to avoid foot entrapments. Those are like the key things. Like if I'm on a trip where I have to give a 1 minute safety talk,
what's
a 1 minute safety talk?
Yeah.
I'm not going to talk about how to paddle. I'm going to be like, you have to wear your life jacket. You have to wear your wetsuit. You have to wear your shoes. You have to wear a helmet. And if you fall out, get your feet up.
You could do this question as which of the following, and say kind of each one will have three elements and you pick the order that you would go with. Like
one would be, it's a good idea,
wearing PPE and then how to battle the team and then no drugs, or you know, change the order around.
Yeah, this one is definitely controversial.
Your priorities.
Yeah.
But it's also hard to prioritize these.
Yeah.
Like I think that wearing PPE is the most important, and I'm biased because I have strong feel. You can probably tell. No. I feel strongly about this. But like after this, prioritizing those is pretty tough. Actually, I think they're all like really important. I couldn't prioritize the next three.
Yeah.
So what we got for the other three? We got the paddling, no drugs and alcohol. And what was the other one?
What to do when you swim.
What to do when you swim.
Which is kind of related to foot entrapment. So that one's like on that same thing.
I would say how to paddle as a team is number two. What to do when you swim might be three. And no drugs or alcohol might be one.
But I would say no drugs or alcohol is next, because that's a huge – that's how people die on rivers a lot. Then
yeah,
I would
but like how many of those are commercial clients?
Not that many, because we talk about in the safety talk.
Yeah, they're already drunk in the parking lot. We just keep them up.
I've been there, man. I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, I've been on the safety talk where people are in the circle meeting with beers in their hands. And we've had to be like, if you guys want to go boating, you need to put the beer down right now.
Yeah.
Right. And we probably shouldn't have taken them at all, you know, because they probably had a
beer. Now we're going to cut out how many of our clients, you know, like it's part of that. Like it's the entertainment industry. I'm like, yeah, maybe we should not take them, but we're also, that's our client base.
Not every client. I mean, that's some of the clients.
Not all clients by any means. It's a small percent, but it's a percentage.
The time that stands out to me was it was a women's rugby team and their boyfriends. Right. There were 60 of them on the Merced in California. They had driven a few hours to get there. And, you know, they're driving up all obnoxious with beers in their cars, you know, and we're like, oh, man, what do we do? And I was working for somebody else, and the owner dealt with it. And he's like, all right, guys. It was a pretty classy way to do it. He was like, I want you guys to take one more sip out of your beer and then put them down and no more alcohol till we're done rafting for the day. And they responded pretty well, actually. But, cool. Of course, the right answer is don't take them. Say, hey, guys, you can't go.
Yeah.
It's just really hard to say you can't go after they paid money and drove 2 hours.
I mean, you could split them up, but that would be pretty bad, too.
Split them up like you drink. If you didn't drink standard
sobriety
beer.
Test.
Sobriety test. Yeah. That's definitely the right answer. So, like, you know, if people are drinking, they shouldn't boat. That's just like, that's the right answer. That example I gave is just something I saw somebody do. Nowadays, I'm pretty hardcore on this because that's how people die in rivers. It's alcohol related.
Yeah.
Let's move on. This one, we could beat this one to death. The next one, this one's a little controversial. In a controlled wrap situation where your clients are safely on shore, in what order do you attempt pulling techniques? And just so you know, this came directly from the IRF quiz. This is I just cut and paste this one from the quiz. I'm not going to go through them all because there's just like the order, but the options here are strong arm pull, tube deflation, rope pull, vector pull, Z drag. Basically, what order do you attempt things? And this isn't, every case is different. I get that every case is different, but in general, what do you want people doing first?
Weight shift in boat.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Actually, easy.
This is actually assuming you have a rope on the boat. There's a lot you can do without a rope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not even talking about a rope. Like, I just move to the front of the boat, move to the back of the boat, move to the right, whatever.
That should be actually on this quiz. It should say weight shift on boat. That's a good, I'm going to add that to the new quiz. So not even getting ropes out, just moving people around.
Stop the rope stuff, man. We don't need to put ropes out there.
It does. I mean, that's, for this question, it'd be the guide moving their weight around. It says the clients are on shore.
Oh, yeah. It does say the clients are on shore. Yeah.
Still, move your body weight around. Yeah. Shift that thing around.
Yeah. So I think that's what they're referring to by strong arm pull, which is no ropes. Like, you just, like, use your arms and pull on the boat.
Mm-hmm. Just get out of the, like, stand on the rock that it's stuck on, yard on it for a second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or stand on the boat in one spot and pull it.
Yeah.
So after a strong arm pull, what would you typically do next?
Well, that question, the way it was worded, that seemed like, seemed like the best option. I haven't used tube deflation that much.
I haven't either. I've seen it work.
I'll step on that one. I love it. That's all I do anymore.
Yep.
I don't pull. I do not use ropes on stuck boats anymore.
So Aaron, I don't know if you know Eric Cavagnolo, Dougie and I went to college with him. He guided on Cherry Creek, and he said they saw a lot of wraps. And he's like, I'm all tube deflation now.
Hmm.
My fear with tube deflation, once you've deflated, there's no going back. You've deflated. You can't reflate that tube. So you could make it worse. And I think tube deflation is good for people who have a good sense of wraps. Right, like you guys
know which one to do.
Yeah, like Chris, you've probably been on a bunch of wraps. You know how they come off. You understand the forces. If you're a normal brand new guide and you start deflating tubes, you can make it a lot worse.
Yeah, but it gets worse to a certain point. Like, the boat will just get like floppy, and then it'll wash off. Like it's the analogy I like using on it is like you got a 5-gallon bucket full of water. Right? And that's your boat. Your boat is just a giant bucket. And if you just broke part of that bucket off, the water flows right out of it. It's really easy to move now. Like, the bucket becomes really light because all that water comes out. And that's the same thing with the boat. Once you deflate a corner of that boat, if it's a 4-corner boat or a chamber boat, drop one chamber. Let the water flow out of there. And all of a sudden the boat weighs 5,000 pounds less. And then you just stand on the rocky yard on it one more time and it comes loose.
I think the key to getting wraps off is just making is exactly that, like letting less water get into the boat, like figuring out how to move the boat or transition it so the one side's getting more water than the other side, or just letting one chamber release.
Mm-hmm.
Is there, Chris, strategy that goes into it? Like, chamber?
You have to kind of like look at it and like whichever portion looks like it wants to peel off the rock most. I leave that side inflated, and then the portion that looks like it's making it stick there, that's the portion that I take the air out of, so that that becomes soft and like rolls over and that water can flow out of that. It's not catching that water anymore. And then the portion that's in the current line is still that bucket. It's still grabbing all that current. And so when the one side doesn't have any that bucket to grab onto, the other side just peels it right off. You let the water peel it off for you.
I like that term. Peel it off is how I think of it too.
Yeah.
Like, you're all about peeling that boat off. It's not, you're not pulling it. It's going to peel off in a certain way. Thank you. What were you going to say?
I've, when the valve of the tube that you want to deflate is in the water, the air pressure is enough to keep any water out of that tube?
Yeah. So this becomes a question that you're going to ruin the boat, or you're going to get water in the boat. If you take a balloon and you shove it into your bathtub and you let some air out of it, does water go into the balloon?
No,
it doesn't. When the boat's underwater, when it's submerged like that, there's so much pressure on the boat that the PSI inside the boat has gone up because of that pressure on there. Yeah. So the air has that place to escape. The water's not going back in until you get down to no PSI.
Yeah.
But you can also get the water out.
Yeah. Right? You got some water in it, go back to the shop, fire up the shop vac, suck it right out of there. Not a big deal.
Yeah. Take the valve off. It'll come out real fast.
Yeah.
So and I think we're all this one's pretty easy, I think, for us. After tube deflation, then get a rope. If that doesn't work, then you get a rope on it and just pull with a rope. Then I think people generally think the vector pull is the way to go, which I've never had luck with it, but people swear by it. And the Z rig last. The mechanical advantage is everything is bad, go to that last. Do you guys agree that's a good order?
Yeah.
We're kind of headed down that route.
Then it's a time frame thing too. You're not causing the trip extended amounts of time if it's out there. That's the smoothest, quickest, least hazardous way to go about doing it, I think.
And again, some people are I don't know, when I work on the Alsek River, but we get that this doesn't work in every situation, every river. This is just a general flow order of operations that we should go on. We don't want guides showing up that says, oh, wrap, that means Z-rig, right? People have that mentality, wrap, Z-rig. That's a tool that's at the end of the list typically. On the Tuolumne, there's a rapid rock garden that people wrap in a lot. And I had seen so many wraps there that I just know that that's a Z rig. So we just started being all right, guys, we've been here before. Let's just do what always works. We've done this, so I've got a Z rig first before just in a specific spot because I've been through the process enough. But otherwise, I would never do that first.
I 1,000% agree on that. There's places where it's you've just gotten accustomed to it. I know where there's anchors are. This is the rock we're going to use to get the boat off of that rock because I've been here before. Yeah. But since I started really, really getting on the whole deflation bandwagon, I haven't pulled a rope out since. I've had a couple underwater, gone, horrible wraps, and I haven't used a rope on them lately.
That's what Aaron's telling me too. I mean, he's like, I haven't done one on ropes in a long time. I do think though, you have to be a pretty experienced boater before there's a lot of judgment that goes into tube deflation.
Yeah.
You have to be able to look at it. You can't have no knowledge of wraps and just start deflating tubes and expect
success. No, I'm not telling the rookie, the entry level guy to do that. I'm definitely not, but it's something that the more experienced people should be fiddling with. Where's that transition? Where do you stop just yarding on stuff all the time and then turn into the Z drags? Or when do you start to do the deflation? I mean, heck, I think it took me 12 years to become, to go to that as my go-to. Take your ropes, put them away. I'm going to get the boat off by myself. It's fine.
Yeah.
You can help me back up afterwards.
I've never had success with tube deflation. I have gotten really good at looking at the boat and figuring out how to peel it off with a throw bag. I'll get one throw. I've showed up to wraps where there's a Z rig and I'm take it off. You guys are pulling from the right angle.
Yeah.
Pull on this tube with this rope. And then we end up peeling it off.
Yeah. You pull on it. It's the right angle. There's so much, you think about how much friction is going on there. That's why it's not there. Why it's there. There's so much friction involved. If you can just pull in the right direction, it just, let the water do its job. It wants to go downstream.
But after talking to you and Aaron about this, I'm going to try tube deflation more when I show up to wraps.
Yeah.
Let's move on. The strongest Avenger is Thor, Hulk, Captain Marvel, Hawkeye, or Avengers is for nerds.
I'm not going to say Avengers are nerds, but people that like them are nerds, but you definitely are a nerd.
I get that. No, I'm cool with that. Dougie?
Marvel, maybe?
Captain Marvel is definitely the strongest Avenger. Captain Marvel's way overpowered. She can fly through Thanos' ship. I mean, she's just the strongest. If you've watched Marvel movies, it's pretty hands down. And I did a trip with some kids this summer who referred to her as OP, which is what kids say for overpowered. Like, she's just like, it's not even fair. She's in the game. But so that's the right answer, Captain Marvel. All right, next. This one's pretty straightforward. I think almost everybody agreed with the answer in this one. In the event you are faced with a foot entrapment scenario that is life-threatening, what is your first priority? Swim downstream to the victim and attempt to rescue them. That's A. B, throw a throwback to the victim. C, raft toward the victim and try to rescue them as you float by. Or D, ensure that the victim breathe.
Yeah, you can take as much time as you want to with the rest of the stuff as long as they're breathing.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. Like, step one is getting them breathing. And I think that I've never been on a foot entrapment scenario. My guess is that everyone is like radically different. And there's some techniques you can use, but it's almost like you have to basically use your training and do the best you can, but keeping the breathing is key.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think almost everyone got this one right.
The amount of time that, like, it gets kind of gruesome, right? But, like, the amount of time that our clients have in the water with a foot entrapment, if they go head down, you have to be there instantaneously. Like, it's heads up or we're doing a body recovery. Like, it has to happen so crazy fast. That's such a creepy scenario.
Yeah, I did read an account recently of a foot entrapment. Somebody was entrapped and they got free, where they were head underwater and there was an air pocket for him. And so he was like basically underwater completely. And he was like, wow, I can't believe I have an air pocket to breathe behind, because the force of the current left some, created an eddy behind his head. So even if they're head down, like you have a chance, but you definitely want to.
I'm not saying give up, but man. there's one, if you ever get a chance, look this one up, up on OB Joyful out in Colorado. This guy gets pinned in his kayak. He spends like an hour pinned underwater. An hour. He's breathing out of like a little horrible air pocket.
That's crazy. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on. The next one, this one is pretty controversial too. Where should the safety gear and first aid kit be located? A, lead boat, B, last boat, C, it depends, D, trip leader, or E, the person with the highest first aid and rescue certification.
Well, C is easy, right? It depends.
Yeah.
I chose answer B, last boat.
Last boat. So the answer I put was it depends, and some people got really upset at me for this. Like, it doesn't depend. This is always the answer. And I think my
good luck with anything being always in the white water world. Right.
Yeah, but this one's because Dougie and I learned last boat. Like, my background is always the last boat, and that way, because the last boat's always going to catch up with the group. Where if it's in the first boat and something happens behind them, you can't go backwards. So yeah,
it's much harder to paddle back upstream.
Yeah, so most people actually answered this last boat, and I think that's common consensus. When I took the IRF course last spring, Mark told me the answer is first boat, and I'm like, that makes zero sense. And Mark said because the first boat is typically the trip leader, and the trip leader typically has the most experience with these things, and so you want them with that person. And we talked about it a little bit. He's like, well, yeah, that's assuming the trip leader always has visual along the group.
Right.
So, like, that's assuming four boats and people have tight boat spacing. You know, we're working multi-days where the front boat doesn't have visual on the last boat. And
we do 10 boat pods on the Arkansas. Yeah. And, man, like, unless you're truthfully bumper to bumper, there's plenty of places where you can't see the whole pack.
Yep, absolutely. So that's why I think last boat is a good standard. But having it with a trip leader makes sense. And then some people wrote answers pretty, like, they really felt strongly the person with the highest level of experience should have it, right?
Which isn't one of your answers.
Which is the person with the highest first aid and rescue certification. Or, yeah, they're basically the most experienced. So it doesn't matter if they're first boat or last boat, just with them is the answer. But how do you determine that person? Like, what if two people or three people are equally experienced?
And experience and certification is not the same
thing. It's not the same thing. It's like,
yeah.
Do you have an order? Do you like, did all the guides get put next to each other and say, okay, you're the most experienced last train. You're number two. Like,
The stand up tall, the shortest to tallest. Let's figure out who's got the medical training.
It's hard to pick that person. You know, maybe they're equal. Maybe there is, and assuming that's the trip leader doesn't always have the most experience in training either.
Right.
No. So I think this one just totally depends. And I don't think it always has to be last boat, because maybe the last boat is your, typically you want your most experienced boater in the front leading the way, you know, so, so if you don't want the front, you can't have the most experienced person if they're in the front, if the boats get spread out. So this one, just, there's a lot of ins and outs to it. So I would just say it depends.
Yeah. I mean, if you gave me an option, like it depends on all these questions, that's the one I would answer with.
Always going to take it. And this one was like, it was purposefully like a mess. Like there's so many options. But if you would have asked me this a year ago before I take the IRF class, I would have said last boat. Mm-hmm. But because of the discussions I had with Mark, it opened my eyes to other possibilities.
And that's mostly just because last boat might not be very experienced with some of these. Like I feel like I'd be okay with them if they're medium experience. If they're brand new, maybe.
I always try to have like somebody that's good up front, good in the back, and then like kind of the mess in between. But like sometimes when I'm TLing and like I might be the strongest paddler out there, I might take the big red flag boat and like just hang out in the middle and let the rest of the people keep an eye on me.
Take the weakest guess. I actually like, sometimes I like the strongest person to be second, because if the first boat flips, you want the best person to do that downstream recovery. So I think that every situation in a boat, like who you put where, depends on a lot. Like, is it big water? Is it continuous? I think it's just really complicated. So locating the safety gear and first aid kit, I think is, it's a complicated thing. And there's a lot that goes into it. And there's not like, if we're following IRF standards, the answer here might be lead boat, because that's kind of what they're teaching. I feel like that's not always the answer. And the one thing I liked about the class was talking to Mark, was he was like, yeah, cool. No, that makes sense. Like, do you, like, you've thought about it, you get it. Like, it doesn't have to be a certain way. All right. The next one is the primary duty of the trip leader. And the keyword here is primary. So it can't be all of the above, because it says primary is provide leadership for the guides and passengers, look good and inspire confidence, give the safety talk and be the lead raft, or be the point person for the guests, or all of the above, which it can't be because it's the primary duty. What do you guys think?
I thought this was like the only one that was simple or that I didn't like balk at, I think, on the questionnaire. I just want A.
Provide leadership for the guides and passengers.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. I mean, that all those things are things the trip leader can do and does, but like...
Does, but yeah.
The trip leader doesn't have to give the safety talk always. No. They can have somebody do it who's good at it. Tripler doesn't have to be the lead raft, doesn't have to always be the point person necessarily.
But I mean, the trip leader's over there hanging out with the bee sting and making sure the evac vehicle shows up and does all the rest of that stuff well. Guide B is doing the safety talk for the rest of the clients, so it all goes smooth and no one knows that anything happened. That happens all the time.
Yeah, a lot of people put all the above, but that was a trick question because it said primary duty, not the duties of a trip leader. All right, next, the proper paddle raft command to turn the boat to the right is right turn or right forward, left back, left forward, right back, bring around, one of my favorites, and it's up to the guide.
It's definitely up to the guide, but yeah, definitely up to the guide. There's reasons and theories for some of these, and like I could break some of this down, but like I've seen spectacular guides use the most ridiculous phrasing and the clients do spectacular.
Yeah. So the most common answer for this, people answered right, left forward, right back. That was what most people answered. Dougie and I learned right turn.
I'll usually say right turn, right side back, left side forward or whatever. But I'll usually say right turn.
Yeah, I'm a right turner because we learn that way. That's how we were learned. But I think that's most people use left forward, right back.
I want that the side that's going to do the back stroke I want to make sure that happens.
Yeah.
The forward stroke on the other side, like typically we're rafting, we've got downstream momentum. So that forward stroke on the far side to me really doesn't matter nearly as much as that backstroke. That's what's really going to shift, like change the momentum of the boat. I'm super jaded on this. I don't use a lot of turn commands in the first place, but I think that that backstroke is what's really going to change the direction of the boat. Heck, I use a lot of forward on one side or forward on the other side on those really tight little narrow chute kind of things. Where I physically can't get my paddle in, I might ask for like one side to go forward or the other side to go forward. But man, I don't use a full turn command anymore.
I let the water do it. I do that because it engages the crew. Like it get like yeah, if I just if it's right back only, the left side is just kind of like bored. And so a lot of my guiding is just keeping people engaged in the boat and being part of the team. So I like them both doing it. But what I'll do is right turn. And if they're doing it wrong, I go, hey, right side back, right side. Like you're right. The right side back does all the work. And so I'll like right side go backwards.
Right.
Like I kind of don't care about the left side unless they are going backwards and counteracting.
Yeah, unless they're messing it up.
But I do it to engage them, just so that they're part of the team. They have something to do. They're not there to sit there with a paddle in their hand and look at birds. Well, sometimes they are actually. So yeah, I think this one, it's up to the guide. Like the guide can choose the commands. You know, they're the ones teaching the guests.
Yeah. And I don't like commands. I hate the word commands.
What do you like?
Suggestions. I don't care, but not commands. Like, I don't like it. They're out here to be on vacation. They're my clients. I'm working with them. I don't want to have commands. You know, like a lot of times, like, hey, I've got a couple little things I like to, you know, call out for out there. Got this and that, but like I don't use the term commands because that like sounds like I'm like playing the dictator role, you know, like that's not what I'm trying to work. I'm trying to work with them. I'm not trying to give them orders.
So the bring around, if I'm trying to just like have fun with nice people, I have two commands. It's bring around and keep her steady. So bring around says like keep whatever it takes to make the boat go straight down the river is bring around, and keep her steady is like just keep her going straight down the river. So if I just want to have fun with the group and the river's easy, those are my two commands.
I personally like to flail differently.
We learned that from our friend Bubba, who's a private boater, and he guided a boat down Cherry Creek, Giant Gap, which is a hard class 5 run in California, a private trip. Yeah. And he used those two commands. He just didn't know the commands. He was like, he's a cat boater who got put in a paddle boat. And he was like, bring it around. And ever since then, we just used it as a joke. All right, the last question is the best throw bag rope for most rafting trips is A, 50 feet of Spectra, B, 75 feet of Spectra, C, 75 feet of any 3/8-inch rope, or D, the longest rope you can accurately throw.
I know what you want for the answer here.
what do I want?
You want D for the answer. But I'm gonna shoot it all to hell because I don't think about the throw rope as being something I can throw. That's its only limitation is how far I can throw it.
Yeah, no, that's a good. I agree with that. So my answer is C, 75 feet. Like the answer I like the most is C, 75 feet of an 3/8-inch rope. I think that 3/8-inch rope is really important because you can grab it and pull. If it's thinner, it's hard to pull on it. And so it's a rope size you can handle. I don't particularly care about Spectra rope that much, personally. But the IRF standard, like what Mark taught us, was the longest rope you can accurately throw, which makes a lot of sense, right? Like if you can't throw, you know, if you can't throw it to a swimmer, it's, you know, it's pointless no matter what the rope is.
No. I think about like sections like when we're working up on Pine Creek, I'm doing a lot of shore-based safety up there. It's narrow. It's super narrow. Mm-hmm. I'll split the rope in half. So I'll have two different shots. I'll be able to toss one chunk out and toss a second chunk out. If that was on a bigger river and I was able to throw 50 feet in a coil with the first one and then I could throw 75 feet on the other side, then I want like 112 foot throw bag, like then I have two shots at it. Like that's spectacular.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's so many other uses of rope. Like what about that? Like we've got a big wide river that's like 200 feet wide and somebody managed to go out there in the middle of that shoal and get a foot of entrapment out there, and we're going to do a snag line on them. You want to do that with four 50-foot lines, or you want to do it with, like, the longest damn rope anybody's got? Like, I'd totally trim that down. Like, I want some length. I've been running, like, 80-some-odd feet in my throw bag for commercial work now. I can't throw that all the way out, not without, like, my shoulder going with it. Maybe, like, if I'm all hyped up and it's a, you know, a legit emergency, like, I could wing that thing out there 80 feet, but I don't want to practice that. That's going to hurt.
Especially if it's wet.
But you could, but if you had, like, quarter-inch Spectra, you could probably wing it.
Yeah, I mean, it's, like, at the brink of my line. And that's what I'm using. I'm using quarter-inch Spectra. I agree on the Spectra thing. It doesn't really matter. As soon as you put a knot in there, it loses so much of its tensile strength. If you don't believe me, do some research online. It loses so much strength.
And nobody's breaking throw bags is not a thing that's happening. It's not a worry in our life. Like we're not snapping throw bag lines. Like, nobody's putting them to the test unless you're using them for, like, a 3-to-1, which you shouldn't be doing anyway.
Yeah, unless you're using it for a Z-drag, and then typically if you're doing that, you're ripping apart the boat, like, pulling D-rings off by the time that's happening, and, like, you're pulling at the wrong angle at that point.
So I'm kind of torn on this one because I've always felt like 75 feet is a good length. Mm-hmm. And the most common use I have for throw bags is hanging gear in camp, like, to dry. So, like, like, you want a longer rope to hang gear in camp. But I think a lot of also, like, our friend Travis was wrapped, or no, Daniel wrapped, I don't know if you were there, on Cal Salmon. There's a rapid, what's that big rapid, like, Cal Salmon? Locomotive or yeah. Freight train. He wrapped on the left middle of freight train, and we had to get him a rope, and we threw him, like, 5 times. And he was exactly, like, 70 feet away. We had a 75-foot throw bag, and we just kept missing him. And Travis stepped up and made the toss finally. That's why Travis was on my brain. But, you know, there's times when you need to get a rope out pretty far to a friend.
Yeah.
And so, like, I'm torn between, like, a standard 75 feet because it's multi-purpose tool or the longest rope you can throw. And I think that this is an IRF question in a lot of ways, because the IRF sort of teaches that you have your own waist belt throw bag, that you as a guide go buy the throw bag that's best suited for you and you wear it around your waist. Where I think a lot of in the U.S., the company provides the throw bag.
Out in Colorado, none of us, not that I know of, like, but most of us are all carrying our own personal bags. West Virginia is all personal bags.
Okay, that's good to know. I like that. It definitely in California, where I started here in Oregon, the company provides, and they're typically, like, cheap NRS ones that fall apart, and they're typically cheap. They're not expensive, so they're not Spectra. It's just, like, whatever NRS sells.
Yeah, the cheapest quality they can find.
I think we're going to disagree on this one. I think if you're going to buy your own, like, having one you can throw as far as you accurately can is pretty key.
Plus 10 feet.
Plus an extra 10 feet. Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, like, whatever your long shot is, but plus a couple feet. Because, like, when you're all fired up, you can throw it a little bit further. And it's not going to – if it's got 10 feet of line in it when it lands, that didn't stop you from throwing it your maximum distance. Or if it did, it stopped your maximum distance by a foot, you know, like, to have a little extra in there. Like, I've tossed it and, like, it's landed in the eddy on the far side, and the person's, like, ran out and grabbed it and had just enough slack left in the bag that they could bring it into shore. Like, having a little bonus in there never hurts anything.
So this is a good example of the point of a quiz, right? Like, I just learned something. Hopefully people listening just learned something. If this quiz question is suspect, right? Like, there's definitely, like, not an exact right answer, but the discussion that we can have because of it, I think
is so much better than the question.
Yes. The discussion that it brings up, like, having the answer have a little bit of gray area. It's not just like, this is the answer, move on. The discussion we have because of it, I think, is super, super healthy.
I like what Chris said too about, you can throw the bag in two sides. You can coil some.
Yeah, I never thought about that.
Especially on the if you missed and you're pulling back in, you can definitely throw a bunch there the second time without pulling the whole thing back.
So, Chris, can you explain how you do that again? Like, how that exactly works? Do you start off by uncoiling some of it, or you throw it to a point and hold it?
Yeah. So, like, if I'm the spot that I'm concerned about, like, where we're doing our shore base safety up there, it's narrow. It's only, like, maybe 30 feet to the other side, like, at high water. And so I pull out 30 feet of rope out of my bag, and I coil that in. Typically I'll coil it in my left hand, and that'll be my second shot. and I'll leave the rest of the rope, like another 40, 50 feet of line in the bag. And so I have that bag to toss out there as a first shot. And then if that doesn't work, or if there's a second swimmer, then I can throw that second coil out there as well. It just gives me more options. Like I can grab two swimmers. If I miss once, I have another try. It just gives me more opportunity on, especially on something that's that narrow,
yeah.
Like where I can throw a coil 30 feet. Like I can, I typically when I get up there and I'm setting safety, I'll pull out that coil. I'll grab that 30 feet of coil and I'll whip it out there and I'll make it slap the shore on the other side. Spool it back and coil it a second time, stick it in my left hand, and then grab the bag, knowing that I'm just going to be able to ding somebody with the bag compared to that coil I just tossed.
Yeah. I think 30 feet is a good length to throw a throw bag. Like, although there, I mean, you rarely are throwing 50 feet to save a swimmer. That's just, it's hard to do.
It's hard. Yeah.
It's super realistic.
I mean, if something's happening in there, I'm yelling at him to swim to me first. You know, like, I'm doing all the preemptive stuff, trying to get him to come to me. I'm trying to make that shot that I'm going to end up throwing that bag half of that distance, not the full 30 feet. Like, I want it to be a 5-foot throw, you know? I want them to be on my toes.
Yeah. So the interesting thing about the IRF standard, I'm sorry to keep coming back to this. I'm into it, is that you have to pass the test, you have to throw a throw bag, pull in a swimmer, and do a retoss and pull somebody else coming down 45 seconds later. So you have to do a throw and a rethrow 40, and two swimmers are sent. Like, a swimmer comes down, you bag them, and then 45 seconds after the first swimmer sent, the next one comes down. And so you're taught to do a quick rethrow.
Yeah.
Or expected to do a quick rethrow to become an IRF qualified guide.
So yeah, I mean, that's my, like, I think that's normal. Like, that being able to, like, wrap up a coil real quick and rip out another 20-foot throw, a 30-foot throw, like, man, I really dig that. I think that's, like, when we get swimmers, it's usually in bunches.
Yeah. Yeah, yep, I agree. Well, that's the quiz. I think it sounds like we generally kind of agree on the answers. I think Dougie and I are going to spend some time. I rewrote the quiz, Chris, and it's I think it's twice as long. There's more questions. Dougie's going to do some editing, so I'm gonna upload that quiz here this afternoon. And so
I'll answer other on all of them. Don't worry.
You'll see that I took some of these questions, and adjusted them. And I added some new ones. We'll probably do some edits based off our talk here today. And so I'll send you a link to it. And I'll put it on the – if those of you listening on the podcast, I'll put a link to it on the website if you want to go take the quiz again and provide more feedback. The feedback's been wonderful. And anything else to add about the quiz before we move on?
I want to holler out, figure out why you're basing this off the IRF. What made you so interested in what they thought about this test or their theories?
Their approach. Yeah, I mean, I started off, we teach a lot of rowing classes to private boaters. You know, we do a lot of education here. We do a little bit of guide education, but we do a ton of private boater instruction. And we've been doing it for about 10 years now. And I basically thought we need to get some formal education for ourselves. And there's no formal education for teaching private boaters. Like, I think we're basically the most experienced at private boater instruction, probably in the world. Nobody else even does it. But I'm like, who can I go to get some more instruction and at a high level? And I looked at the ACA, wasn't super impressed with some other stuff. I looked in the IRF and found this guy, Mark Hurst, who I really liked what he had to say in some of his blogs. And so I literally just wanted us to have like a cert behind us a little bit more for teaching our instruction. And so I brought Mark over last year, didn't really know what to expect. I flew him over from Finland, didn't really know what to expect. I was like, you know what, if we just get certified, that helps us have some more authority behind our classes. And I was just blown away by Mark, just really impressed with his knowledge. And, you know, every time I had a gray area question, he was like, no, I get it. But here, let me put some data behind it. So I think it's good that we have some standards. And I think there's a lot of advancements from talking to Mark. There's a lot of advancements in guiding happening in Europe. You know, they're trying to evolve and get better and follow standards. Where in the U.S., we haven't really changed much. And so
what things are changing? What are you seeing? Like, give us a couple examples.
I mean, one is like the clean land principle, you know, just trying our best to have like not like loops of rope everywhere. That's huge in Europe. I think that's a big one. Like, we kind of follow it, but if you go look at an average commercial company, there's sketchy lines everywhere.
I try to run a really tight boat like that.
Yep. That's just good practice. But like, if you go to like your, I mean, you probably, the people you work with, if you're on Gore Canyon, for example, are probably super tight. Go hang out at the Deschutes for a day, or go hang out at the South Florida American. That's not there. So that was a big one. Another one was, I like that 45-second rethrow expectation. I thought that was pretty cool. I like the expectation of guys to be able to flip a boat quickly. For safety talks, they have it kind of broken down on like how to give a good safety talk, the order, you know, things like that, that we just have never really, as individual rafting companies, we've kind of created our own little like expectations that we never have any outside influence on. And he kind of came in and made me rethink some things. And I really respect Mark personally. And I think the IRF is trying really hard to create good standards. And it's full of people with good rafting backgrounds. And they're not perfect. And some of their stuff doesn't apply everywhere. But I went from being like, hey, let's just get this certification, to becoming a fanboy.
Cool. That's a lot more positive outlook on the IRF than I had with some raft racing shenanigans. So it's cool to hear like that there is really some positive stuff there. The other one, if you're like looking for other options, more information, stuff like that, I teach Swiftwater stateside, but I'm not even trying to plug me. What I'm trying to plug is, I went over and did the New Zealand course. Like, my stateside ACA instructor didn't qualify over there, so I ended up going through their course while I was there, and it was pretty fun. There was definitely some people that are like, oh, we're in New Zealand, we do it the best, but whatever. They did have some cool information tucked in there, and a few of the instructors were. It was cool. We were bouncing information off each other. We were really excited about stuff. I'm an adamant 2-to-1 if we're going to do mechanical advantages, not a 3-to-1 person. And so I was like setting all my pig rigs up and all everything else off of 2-to-1s. And they're like just always like scratching their heads at first. And like they'd look at it and like, oh, you got it. You're just doing it different.
Yeah. Well, a lot of the IRS
doing like ankle entrapments with ropes and having to like cut ropes off of us and off of other people, like some wild stuff. It was a cool course.
So a lot of the IRF stuff is based off of New Zealand standards.
Okay.
And so there's a high level of expectation and professionalism in New Zealand. And you have to get a guide license, it's hard. I mean, here to get a guide license, you pay your fee and turn in your CPR card. Out there you take actual
Colorado.
What's that?
There's not even a guide license in Colorado. There's nothing.
Same with California. I think California is the hardest whitewater maybe in the world for commercial boating. And I know people can disagree with me and tell me about whatever, but like that's my opinion. There's no licensing in California.
Yeah.
But both Canada and New Zealand have really awesome, and I think even like France, have a high level of expectation of guides. And they put a lot of thought into these tests and quizzes and like what they have to pass to become a guide. And so the IRF is trying to standardize that across the world, which is hard because, like we said, not every
like every officer has other.
Yeah, everywhere's different. But like the idea is, if you pass an IRF course as a guide, you at least have a base set of skills to take. So, like one of my guides, Ellie, took the course last year, and she got a job in Chile pretty easy because she was a certified Class 4 trip leader, right? Cool. So. The people in Chile, you're not just some rando guide going down there, like, you know, put me to work, I'm going to throw a throwback from a raft. The Chileans knew she had a base level of certification. So I think it just says something to your base level of knowledge. And again, it's hard because there's so much diversity among rivers that there's not everything is exactly the same, but they can sort of distill the key things down to a few things. So I applaud them for trying. And and I worry a lot about guiding. You probably see this, like a lot of raft companies they keep teaching themselves like over generations of guides, and there's never any new influence. And I call it breathing your own smoke.
Yeah, like, for sure. And that happens so many places. And that's I was actually like, I had scribbled down a little note on that. Man, that's and I understand with you running the company there, like, man, it's super hard for you to go out and work at other companies. As somebody that's worked in 6 out of 7 continents, man, it's fun to grab that little tidbit from one company here and from another group over there and like learn something from these guys and pass them off to those folks. And like my safety talk, my, all that stuff has just grown so much. And it's going from the people that I work with consistently out there in Colorado, but it's changed way more when I'm working in Chile, when I'm working in Africa, like when I was doing trips in China, and like, I was like, holy cow, I've got to like tighten a bunch of stuff up here. Like, this is super loose. Like, they've got the idea, but it's all, it was like just off. And had to like clean all the corners up again, you know, like, it's a cool experience. And then like when you see that stuff and then you're like actively reteaching it, like that's the classic, right? When you're teaching it, like you get to learn it all again.
Yeah. And I think that's huge. I think that that's the thing, is like the best guides have worked for a lot of companies and seen a lot of different ways of doing things. And there's just a lot of organizations where it's just, there's never new learning coming through. And I think the IRF is a way to bring new learning into an organization.
For sure.
You know, it's like if you have all your guides taken out of course, it just, it creates like an outside influence. So I think it's important for that reason. You know, if you've guided all over the world, you've learned this stuff, but not everybody has.
So yeah. And I mean, we still always have different outlooks on it, you know, like, yeah. I know some people have guided all over the place that still have some like really goofy things that they do, but it works for them, you know, like they figured it out for them. Should we always be using those people as examples? No, don't follow me.
Yeah. Well, let's wrap this up. We've been going for a while. And so we usually finish with what we call gear of the week. Chris or Dougie, do you have any exciting gear you want to talk about?
I just got a new green jacket from Astro, and I haven't used it yet.
Okay.
I just got it 2 days ago. But I'm excited to try it. I was checking out the pockets on it, and yeah, it's pretty sweet. So cool. I like what they've done, and it seems like they keep improving it a little bit here and there.
Now, Dougie, what were you in before?
Coquitat.
Which one?
A ProFit, an old rescue vest they had.
ProFit?
Yeah. It was from, it's
pretty,
pretty
old. It's pretty old. I know Dougie's jacket well.
The one thing I really liked about it that I wish that, I'll miss, is that you could zip it up in the front. So you could put it on pretty easily.
Ronin Pro.
Before Ronin.
Remember Ronin.
When Coquitat had the life jackets where you could pair sunglasses. It's that one, isn't it? Yeah. There's that little mesh thing in between. So
did it float at all?
It's in good shape.
Dougie takes care of his stuff.
Yeah.
Dougie takes care of his stuff.
It should have been retired. So it's time to retire it. But it actually floated great.
Do you still have your green ProTec helmet?
I have it.
Yeah. This is how long Dougie keeps stuff.
Helmet for a while, but no, I've replaced it now.
You replaced it. Okay, so you have another helmet in your green ProTec.
Yes.
Okay. Chris, do you have any gear of the week?
Well, first I'm going to plug the Ronin Pro because I still like that jacket and I've been rocking that thing for years. But the one that I'm digging and just used a ton of on this last China trip constantly every day is Watershed's little backpack system. It's a backpack. Yeah, I kind of dig to the bottom of it. There's not like a lot of extra pockets in there, but they have like a dry backpack for those extended trips when you're not sure what you're gonna get yourself into. Like, I bring it on the plane as my check-on bag. It's just with me. It's been with me for so many international trips now.
Is this like their backpack, like big, I think it's called Big Creek or something like that? Or is this one?
Yeah, there's like Animus and Big Creek and something else like that. But I get the medium size one. It's like a nice medium size backpack, a little bit bigger than like a JanSport. It's turned into my standard issue.
Sweet. Well, on the topic, I didn't have a gear of the week, but I do now. Coquitat has a new PFD out called the Hustle. Have you guys heard of this?
Mm-hmm. It just came out. Got to touch it. It looks cool. I'm staying with my Ronin Pro.
I went over to Outdoor Play the other day. Outdoor Play is based on River, and they had one. I tried it on. It's stupidly comfortable. Like the curved padding it's not just a gimmick. It's
the
really,
curved padding
really
cool. is really good, and then the fabric that's on the inside is that like neoprene. It's the same material that's on like a water skiing life jacket, and that's where they kind of borrowed it, stole it from. We're filling around with it 4 or 5 years ago. It holds up. It kind of like crazy holds up. And I think it's going to be like for the Southeastern gals, it's going to be so awesome for barebacking. Like it actually feels like legitimately comfortable against your skin. Like yeah. It's going to be good.
Well, I have to say like that curve, that PFD felt like a glove. I've never felt anything that comfortable. I was blown away. I thought it was gimmicky, but I liked it. I'm not sure if I liked it. I just tried it on. It's impressive. So if you're looking for a super comfortable PFD, it's only 17 pounds of flotation, and I really am trying to get more flotation in my PFDs, and I'm kind of disappointed. Even the extra large is only 17 pounds.
So why do you want more flotation? Just a question. I know this is going to go into a ramble.
I like to float.
Yeah.
Are you somebody who likes to dive under holes?
I will. That's not plan A. I'd rather be in the boat.
I like to keep my head above water when I swim. Yeah. I'm 220 pounds, so if Dougie's wearing 17 pounds of flotation, he'll keep his head above water. With me, kind of.
The rest of your mass is in the water. It's just your head. We got to float.
Yeah, but like, like if I'm in a lake, I can keep my head above water. But when I'm getting pummeled, I want flotation. Yeah. And I think that diving, I think I get that like you want less flotation to go dive below holes maybe once every 20 years. But in general, when you're getting pummeled down a big rapids, there's rapids.
No, I want to be at the top.
I think floating is key. And I've had this debate so many times that
I need to be able to swim. Like, I don't care how much flotation is in. Yeah. I need to be able to windmill my arms.
Yeah. And like kayaking, it's nice to have flexibility and mobility versus just a bunch of stuff on your body. So yeah. I'd like to see like a 20, 23 pound PFD that's comfortable. And that wearing that Hustle jacket, it feels like nothing. Like
they did the rescue vest.
They're right now it's not, but they're coming out with the rescue version this spring. It's not officially.
They're just gonna they'll redo the harness in there. They'll make sure the harness is beefy and then do the quick release on it. It's gonna be it's super easy to turn those into rescue jackets like that.
Yeah, so I'm interested. I'll check it out. It was stupidly comfortable. I think for me, like, I'm happy wearing the 17 pounds if I'm guiding the Middle Fork or, class 3 kayaking, class 4 kayaking. But if I'm going to run something hard or guide something hard, I want flotation. I have the Astral YTV use for just goofing around. That has the same amount of flotation as the Green Vest. The YTV is the exact same amount of flotation, which is shocking. So they're all basically 17 pounds, but
industry minimum, and they're just kind of all hovering there because that's what's most comfortable on us. But yeah, there's a few of them that have a couple extra pounds in there.
Yep. So a lot of them, the small medium is 17 pounds, and the large extra large is 19.
Yeah.
So I kind of wish they'd done that, like given some extra flotation to us big guys.
Couple extra pounds in there, yep.
So I could also just go on a diet, but
there is. There's some
drink some Corona.
Yeah, that's not gonna help.
There's some buoyancy in your weight too. Like we all have buoyancy in our weight.
Yeah, no, I mean
even
it's
though
true.
You're heavier, buoyancy wise, you're not as proportionally heavier. I think in the water.
Yeah, but I think that you want a PFD that's proportionally to your size too. I think that 17 pounds will float your head above water more than my head above water. I know what you're saying.
Yeah.
But, the current just has more grab on your torso. It's just a bigger surface area.
Yeah.
That's what it comes
cool.
down to.
We probably need to wrap this up. We're almost an hour and a half. This has been a really fun podcast, though. Chris, thank you for podcasting from the parking lot of Home Depot in the rain.
Yeah.
It's nice. And Dougie, thanks for walking over here, driving over here. And, if anybody has any questions, comments, thoughts, you can always email us at questions@rivertalkpodcast.com. And, we'll get the new quiz up today. So check out the website for a link to the new quiz. And I'm excited to see what people say. So, thanks for joining, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you. I'm on Chattahoochee on the Rio Grande. The Allegheny and the Cumberland on the river. All this river's running fine.
the new quiz up today, so check out the website for a link to the new quiz, and I'm excited to see what people say. So, yeah, thanks for joining, guys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Cool. That was a good one. We even had good audio, except for that one hiccup. The audio quality was amazing.
Yeah.